You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report says the nation's Social Security program will cost more money than it's taking in by next year. We'll talk about what that means for Social Security recipients and the long-term health of the program. First, starting a family presents what can seem like an endless list of questions. Some of the classics include, how important is it to breastfeed? Should you spank your toddler? How much time should you let them watch TV? When is it okay to let them start? Our next guest is taking on those questions and many more, but she's doing it with research and data. Emily Oster is a professor of economics at Brown University and the author of the book Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're a parent, you're an economist, it seems like a natural, but talk about why you wanted to have a data-driven approach to all of these parenting questions.
I think when you become a parent, certainly for me, there are a tremendous number of questions. And I am an economist. I like data. I like to make life decisions with data. And when I became a parent, it was easy to imagine doing that through my parenting. But I found that there weren't a lot of resources for that kind of approach. And so I tried to create my own.
And there's a lot of advice out there. And it's been a while since I've parented kids that young, but I had multiple books which would offer exactly the opposite advice on a lot of questions. A lot of the advice out there, big picture, that you looked at just doesn't have anything to back it up.
Yeah, that's right. I think there are a lot of places in this evidence where unfortunately we don't have a lot of evidence. So people tell you it's really important to give your kid rice cereal as their first food, but there's actually no particular reason to do that or not do that. And I think you hit on exactly the problem that everyone has, which is that some people tell you one thing and tell you it's really important to do this, and then the next day somebody tells you something else. And so this book is about, you know, what does the evidence really say and how can you make the decisions that work for you, which, by the way, may not be the same decisions that work for other people.
Before we dig into specific examples of what you looked at, one thing I like about this, and I wish I'd had when my kids were little, you use the phrase more relaxed even in the title. Your book is in large part about things that, hey, as a parent, it turns out you don't really need to freak out about that much.
Yeah, exactly. I think that many of the messages here are, you know, no decision that you're going to make is the decision, right? So when you write a book about parenting, people are like, okay, what's the most important thing I can do to make my kid a success? And the answer is there isn't anything really like that. There are some things that are maybe a good idea to do, but no individual decision is the decision. And I think that's kind of freeing because it sometimes feels like every decision is the decision.
That's how I felt. We're talking to Emily Oster. Her new book is Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. She's a parent. She's an economist. She used both of those skills for this book. Well, one big question, and we hear a lot about this, is breastfeeding. How good is it? How much better is it than formula? You looked at the research. What kind of takeaways did you see?
I think the broad takeaway is that there are some benefits to breastfeeding, but maybe they're not as big as what you hear every day. So there are some things where breastfeeding is helpful. So it seems to lower diarrhea infections in the first year, maybe some effects on eczema among little kids, maybe even some effects for the mom in terms of breast cancer prevention. But some of the more grandiose rhetoric, like breastfeeding is going to make your kid thinner, is going to make your kid smarter, is going to make them healthier for their whole life, there isn't any support for those in the data. Certainly not in the best data. And so I think that takes a little bit of the pressure off of this for a lot of women. So I think this can be something that's really makes people feel bad if it doesn't work for them or if they don't want to do it. And it can be really hard. And I think it's maybe good to dial back a little bit some of the pressure and say, yeah, there are some benefits. There's some good reasons to do it. You might like it. You probably want to try it. We should be supportive of people who want to do it. But this isn't the thing that is going to give your kid the best start without which they will not be successful.
Yeah. So all else being equal, it sounds like you're saying breastfeeding, yeah, is better. But if there are particular obstacles, roadblocks to that, don't feel guilty about it.
Yeah, exactly. There are some benefits. It's good to try. We should be supportive of people who want to try. But it is not the be-all and end-all of successful parenting.
All right. Let's talk. I mentioned spanking, corporal punishment in the setup there. What do we know when we start to look at the evidence of the impacts, positive, negative, in between for corporal punishment?
The evidence does not support the use of corporal punishment, does not seem to improve kids' behavior, and there's some evidence that it has some negative consequences for kids later. So, you know, there are some really good methods of discipline. So being consistent, having a warning system, 1, 2, 3, timeout kind of discipline seems to have a lot of good impacts for kids in terms of improving behavior, improving their relationships with their parents. But those systems do not and should not include spanking or corporal punishment.
All right, now let's turn to screens a little bit. We could spend probably hours just talking about screen-related issues. When my kids were quite young, it was in the, I think, the early days of the baby Einstein and all those DVDs. You show them to your under one-year-old, and it's going to make them smarter and learn language faster. When people tried to study that, what kind of things did they find out?
Yeah, unfortunately, your one-year-old, two-year-old, they cannot learn things from videos. So when people went in and they actually gave some families access to these baby Einstein videos, and some families didn't get it, and they looked at the outcomes, they didn't find any evidence that these videos help. Older kids 3, 4, they can actually learn from TV, and there's some interesting evidence on Sesame Street showing that it actually, when that was first introduced, it improved kids' school readiness. But if you're looking to videos to improve your 18-month-old's vocabulary, you should look somewhere else.
Well, we share this building with our colleagues at Public Television. They'll be happy to hear that Sesame Street for kids who are a little older can give benefits. Unfortunately, I think you share my opinion here. Even Caillou, that Canadian kid, might help the kids out a little, despite what it does to the parents.
I don't know about Caillou. I'm not going to go on record positively about Caillou.
Now, for kids 1 and younger, and there's just stuff in the news lately, they're saying no screens at all for kids 1 and under. Does the research back that up?
Unfortunately, there isn't much research on this. So, you know, when we look at downsides of television, you know, there's some older research that's really focused on TV and on kids that are a bit older. And there, you know, we don't see any evidence that a small amount of TV is bad. You don't learn from it, but it doesn't seem like it has negative impacts. But, you know, the kinds of questions I think parents are asking now are things like, what about the iPad? What about FaceTime? What about apps? And we don't have any evidence. So there are some of these warnings that come out, and they may be based in logic. They're not based in evidence. We haven't had these things for long enough for that to be something we know about, right? So you want to know, well, what's the impact of having an iPad from the time that you're a baby to through high school? Well, those kids are not in high school yet. So I think that really limits what we can know from the data.
Now, one of the more definitive things in the book that struck me is, what should be in the crib with a baby, and how should they sleep?
There should not be anything in the crib with the baby. There are cases in which babies suffocate unfortunately, in cribs full of things. And there's no reason to have anything in the crib with your baby. It may be very cute. You can put it in, take a picture, and take it out again. And when you put the baby down, they should sleep on their back. This has been a campaign. This campaign has been going on to get kids to sleep on their back since the early 1990s. And it's really had big impacts, big positive impacts in terms of preventing SIDS. So kids on their back in the crib, no stuff with them. Those are important.
And this is one of those things that can be, I think, frustrating for parents or parents versus grandparents, because there were campaigns in some countries a generation or so ago that you write that said, no, sleep the baby on their stomach.
Absolutely. This, and people often tell me, you know, like my mother-in-law was like, oh, you have to put them to sleep on your stomach. That's very important. And this really changed between the time that I was a kid and the time that my kids were kids.
We're talking to Emily Oster of Brown University about her book looking at research on common questions in parenting. It's called Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent of younger children now, or you have ever been that, what were some of the questions that had you hitting the books, asking your friends about, going online to try to find the answers to? What did you end up going with? Did you find mutually contradictory pieces of advice from the people you talked to and the sources you went to? Or do you have a question for our guest about how she tried to tackle some of these issues in parenting using the research as it currently exists? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Emily Oster about her new book on what research says about some of those big parenting questions, like the best way to potty train a toddler and how to discipline kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a parent now or in the past, where do you go for advice? Other people, conventional wisdom, the internet, a book, a particular book, a bunch of books? What do you go to answer these questions? And do you have a question for a guest about some of these questions you might have had from age 0 to 3 for a kid? She might have tackled it in her book. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Emily's new book is called Crib Sheet, A Data-Driven Guide to Better, More Relaxed Parenting from Birth to Preschool. Let's go to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. I'm calling with probably one of those relax, don't worry about it so much stories. When I had my first baby, and it was, the time when she wanted to start, experimenting with food, like 6, 8, 9 months, something like that. And the recommendation was, that rice cereal, there's lots of iron in it. It's important to get iron for your baby. So she hated it. And I was very concerned, went to the doctor for a well baby checkup and said I was concerned about her iron because she hates that cereal. And the doctor said, well, what does she eat? What does she like to eat in addition to, breast milk? And so, well, she loves Braunschweiger. And the doctor just started laughing because it's liver sausage and it's full of iron.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. That's a Wisconsin kid, I'll tell you. Emily, yeah, we can in some ways be more relaxed about what our kids are eating as long as they're consuming, I guess, something and something decent.
No, absolutely. And I think that, often people get this idea that food introductions have to be exactly in this order, and there's the rice cereal and there's the vegetables and the fruit. And the truth is there are a lot of good ways to introduce food. It doesn't have to go like that. I often say my son's first solid food was congee at the Chinese restaurant, which was it was a form of rice cereal, but not the bland kind that they recommend.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Rebecca. We'll go now to Erica in Westby. Erica, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Erica?
I just wanted to disagree with her in the sense that she said there wasn't one thing that she thinks you can do to give your child an advantage as you're raising him. And I think that reading to your child is the one thing you can do that no matter what will give them an advantage.
Erica, thanks for that call. And you looked at reading and how we read to kids. Emily, what did you see there?
Yeah, so I absolutely agree that reading is important, and we do see good evidence that reading to your kid helps them prepare them for school readiness. And there's also a lot of interesting stuff around what even happens in kids' brains. We know from brain imaging that kids who are read to more have an easier time. Seems like they're visualizing when they do get read to. So I absolutely agree that reading is important. I didn't mean to imply that there weren't things that were important. Just that this idea that there's one thing that that's the only thing and that's I think they're even reading is probably not like that, although it is a great idea.
But also, thanks a lot for that call. Also, the idea that no matter what you do, there's a certain age before which your kid is not going to learn to read, right? There's no
your
magic
kid,
way to start at 6 months and they can read all of a sudden.
Your baby cannot read. That's right. You can read to them, they cannot read.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Kayla in Milwaukee. Kayla, hi.
Hi. My big baby thing that I'd research all the time was sleep training. I was pulling my hair out trying to figure out what would work, and one article told me I was coddling him, and another article told me I would give him abandonment issues if I let him cry for too long. So I always felt like there was nothing I could do. And at one point, I was superstitious, he slept the night in this onesie. This must be the magic onesie he has to sleep in every night.
Kayla, thank you so much. Wow, she is so not alone, Emily. The quandaries over how to get your kid to sleep on schedule.
No, absolutely. And I had a very similar experience to that onesie experience. But yeah, when we look at sleep training, a lot of parents wonder about the issues of cry it out and does that going to work? And is it going to damage my kid? And I think there the data is pretty reassuring that actually the method of letting your kid cry, it does on average make kids sleep better. It improves sleep for parents and actually lowers depression, improves marital satisfaction. So there are good reasons to sleep. And on the other side, people who are worried that this is going to damage their kid. When we look at the evidence on that, we just don't see any evidence that this is bad for kids in either the short term or even in the longer term. So I think for parents who want to do that, the evidence is pretty reassuring. And you know, although it is hard to do in the moment, it may not be for everyone.
Kayla, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to economist and parent Emily Oster about her book, Crib Sheet, A Data-Driven Guide to Better, More Relaxed Parenting from Birth to Preschool. Back to your calls now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. I have a question for your guest. She mentioned a little while ago about the improvement in the statistics regarding SIDS since the Back to Sleep campaign in the 1990s. And I was wondering what the statistics were. My children were born in the 1980s and they slept on their tummies. And fortunately, they all survived, but I am aware of SIDS. And I was wondering what was the rate per 1,000 or 100,000 as far as cases of SIDS before the Back to Sleep campaign, and what is it now since the Back to Sleep campaign has been implemented.
Thanks, Gwen. I don't know if you have numbers in front of you, Emily, but ballpark if you don't.
Yeah, so I mean, this is actually a little bit of a tricky thing to answer because it's hard to know exactly which infant mortality to attribute to other things, to different things. But I think the answer is it's about half. So the risk is about half of what it was from that cause.
Thanks a lot for the call. And it was to be clear to her, it was rare at no matter at any point, right? It just got even more rare after the Back to Sleep campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, although this is a very scary thing to think of, you know, SIDS rates have always been low, and they are really low now. But this has been responsible in part for some of those declines.
Let's bring out another caller now. Blair is with us in Madison. Blair, hi.
Hi. I was just calling to say thank you. And also, the thing that works, the one right thing for your first kid, turns out is not always the right thing for your second or third kid.
That is 100% right. And I think the thing is, you can, as a parent, if you're doing something with your first kid, you're like, oh, I'm so great. I really got this parenting thing down. I've gotten it right. And then your second kid comes along and you're like, oh no, I can't believe that I thought I was doing it right. How am I supposed to parent this one? So I totally agree. Families are different, but kids are different too.
Thanks a lot, Blair. And that reminds me, Emily, you talk about, you know, when kids hit a developmental stage, when they start crawling or walking or speaking or anything like that. It's easy to freak out if they're not in that what's called the average range. What should parents be looking at there?
I think mostly you should be aware that there's a distribution. I think it's funny. We always talk when kids are we weigh or measure kids. We say, oh, this is where they are in the distribution. But when we tell people, when should your kid be walking? We say, like, oh, they should walk about a year. But of course, some kids walk at 7 months and some kids walk at 18 months. And those are both totally normal. And so when you're sort of waiting, like, why isn't my kid walking? Actually, it's probably fine.
And yeah, and the kid who's walking at 7 months isn't necessarily going to be better in life in some way than the kid that walks at a year and a half.
Exactly. They're all going to learn to walk. And later, you know, you're not going to find out because your kid walked late, they're not good at sports.
Yeah. And I'll say, as a parent of twins, they're off the situation where, wait, one kid's doing the thing, the other kid isn't doing the thing. Is something wrong? Well, and it was, you know, a difference of a matter of like a week out of that whole range.
Exactly.
Let's bring on one more caller. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
What'd you want to tell us about, Mike? Good.
I just wanted to call. About 3 months or so, we found this series of DVDs called Baby Signing Time. And essentially, it's this lady who comes on, and it's kind of Sesame Street-ish. and they do these little things, and they show very simple sign language. And we started showing these with our son, and then we would use the signs, like for milk or for more or for water, you know, different, like, very simple signs. And we went actually pretty quickly between, like, 3 and 6 months from, like, a lot of crying and not knowing what he needed to actually being able to use some of these really simple signs, you know, actually let us know what he needed. And it made life a lot easier.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah. Emily, I've heard of people doing this. I can't remember if you tackled that in your book, the signing.
I talk a little bit about sign language as one of the early kinds of language that kids can have, although not, I don't actually delve too much into it, maybe in the next edition. But I totally agree with the view that as your kid learns to express themselves, whether verbally or earlier, they can usually do signing before they can talk. It's such a relief as a parent to find, like, oh, now I know what you want. You're not just screaming at me and I'm trying to guess. Is it your diaper? Is it your are you hungry? Like, you know, do you want to go for a walk? So communication is really great.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. Emily, in our last minute or so, did hitting the books and doing this kind of data-driven research, did it make you feel more relaxed as a parent?
I think it's sort of ironic that me, like the world's most neurotic parent, has written this book about being relaxed. But I do think that there is something relaxing about having the data, at least for me, although the process of getting the data has not always been so relaxed.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Emily Oster, a professor at Brown University, author of the new book called Crib Sheet, A Data-Driven Guide to Better, More Relaxed Parenting from Birth to Preschool.